From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. While Granite Staters are being told to work from home as much as possible, that's not an option for the state's first responders, police, firefighters, and emergency medical technicians. These professionals have to be out in the community, and social distancing is often just not possible. Today in The Exchange, how first responders are working with the new demands and constraints of the coronavirus, and the dangers too. For example, four Manchester police officers have tested positive for COVID-19. Let's hear from you, whether you have personal experience with this topic or you just have questions about what you've seen in your city and town. We welcome your input. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Again, 1-800-892-6477. And you can use Facebook or Twitter as well. We begin with the police perspective. Later on, we'll talk with people who work in emergency medical services and a fire chief. Joining us now on the line is the City of Franklin's Police Chief, David Goldstein. And Chief Goldstein, a big welcome back. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Laura. Happy to be with you.
What's most stressful for you, Chief Goldstein, about this whole thing for you and your team?
Well, for me personally, it's the safety and well-being of my officers and my civilian personnel, quite frankly. We still have some small degree of walk-in traffic, if you will. We still have to deal with people in conducting interviews and investigations and what have you. And we're out there in the midst of all of this. And sometimes we don't know what we're going into, so we may not have time to put on personal protective equipment or PPE, as it's come to be known. So that's my biggest concern right now.
You know, I'll ask you definitely about the PPE in a moment, because I know that's a huge issue. But you talked about the safety and well-being of your staff and said you're still taking people who are walking into the police department with questions and so forth. Some departments, from what I understand, Chief Goldstein, have closed their lobbies down, but yours is still open.
Yeah, we've left the lobby open for people to come in. We certainly are separated by glass, either on dispatch side or the walking side for our things such as pistol permits and what have you. But there are times when we still have to meet face-to-face with individuals. Crime has not gone away. It has seemed to have lessened a little bit for the moment, but it certainly hasn't gone away. We're still dealing with some very serious issues in the city. And as a result, we do have to meet with these folks. One of the things we've tried to do is locate a couple of off-site locations where only the individuals we're dealing with and the officers or detectives meet, so that the rest of the department remains separate from all of that.
Because really, practicing social distancing is incredibly difficult for you. You've got to interact with the public. Is that correct, Chief Goldstein? Are you able to do social distancing at all?
Well, we try. We've instituted some policies and procedures, if you will, for the moment. For example, if we go to someone's house and we don't have to go into the home, we'll ask them to step outside, and we will certainly maintain some significant difference in speaking with them. If we stop a car, for example, we'll stay further back than we might have in the past. And by the way, we're not yelling at you. It's just that we may have to speak a little bit louder because the traffic is still going by and we're further away. So things like that, I really leave it up to my officers to decide how they want to handle all of these situations. And so far, so good. We've had a couple scares, but everything's come up negative, and we're happy about that.
Okay, so you've had a couple people tested and it's come up negative. So that's definitely an issue that police and firefighters and EMTs are dealing with. And we'll talk a little bit later in the show with a fire chief and an emergency medical technician. How has the coronavirus, Chief Goldstein, changed the types of calls that you get from the public? For example, are you tending to fewer car accidents because there are fewer people on the road? What kinds of calls are you getting now and how has that changed?
Well, that's an interesting question, Laura, because in one sense, you're absolutely correct. We're not having as much interaction with the public, let's say, in a motor vehicle sense. So we're not seeing the results of that, such as an arrest for operating after suspension or revocation, just by way of example. At the same time, you're absolutely correct. People are driving less, and I liken it to a Sunday morning commute. When I come up 93, it's almost as if every day is Sunday. And then when I get into the city, the same type of thing. Parking spaces, absolutely empty parking spaces on the main streets of the city. So we do see that change, quite frankly. But we're also seeing some other stuff. And one thing that's bothering me is I've noticed that, and this is kind of a given anyway, when traffic enforcement, by way of example again, lessens, sometimes other things take its place. And I'll drive around the city, for example, and I'll see all these weight transfer marks, donuts in the road where somebody has at some point in time accelerated rapidly, spun their car around in a main street and gone on their way. That tells me that they can get away with this because the traffic enforcement isn't there. So that's just a negative side of things. Just for Franklin, I don't know how that's working in other cities or towns right now.
That's interesting. So people say, hey, look how empty the street is. I think I'm going to, you know, do some donuts.
Exactly. And if you drive through Franklin, you'll see probably at this point about a half a dozen locations where that has occurred. Again, we worry also on other levels. For example, I know there's been a great deal of discussion about domestic violence issues and abuse types of issues with children being home. Just the fact that people are now put together in a situation where folks go to work every day and they say goodbye in the morning, they say hello in the early evening, and they've got that time to themselves. Now we're looking at people who have been thrown together in one sense, unexpectedly, even though they're partners and they know each other well. Sometimes that doesn't always work. So we're seeing a little bit of that as well.
Interesting. So an increase in domestic violence and child abuse calls, Chief Goldstein?
Well, not to a large degree right now, but certainly something that we're hearing about.
Sure.
Something that we're being very cognizant of and trying to keep track of. But not to the degree that people were when all of this started. People were very afraid that, oh my goodness, the society is going to explode. No, we haven't seen that, quite frankly. But we are seeing a little bit of blip on the screen here and there. So we're just keeping our eyes on that.
And we're going to spend 2 hours on that topic tomorrow from 9 to 11, both abused and neglected children and then also people in domestic violence situations. So we're going to talk about that tomorrow in the exchange. A couple other questions that I had for you, Chief Goldstein, about the types of calls that you're getting. Are people calling you to report large gatherings, you know, saying, hey, Chief, there's 10 teenagers playing basketball at the park, or, you know, my neighbor's having a party and we're not supposed to be holding large gatherings? Are you getting those sorts of reports?
Interestingly enough, not so much that type, but we're getting reports on businesses that are trying to circumvent the orders, the executive orders from the governor's office. So without naming names, of course, let's say a pawn shop wants to remain open to lend money, but not open to the public. So now it's by appointment, when in point of fact, that's not acceptable and actually violates the executive order. So we've had a few of those where we've had to go to the individuals and say, look, we understand what's going on. We understand that this is your business. This is your life. This is your livelihood. However, here's what we have to work with. We ask that people comply. And so far, we've gotten pretty much almost 100% compliance when we do that.
That's interesting. Well, again, I want to remind our listeners that today in the exchange, we are looking at how New Hampshire's first responders are dealing with the new demands of the coronavirus. We invite you to share your experiences or your questions, especially right now as we talk about police issues with Franklin's Police Chief David Goldstein. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. So when people call in, when they make a call to the Franklin Police Department, are there extra questions that you have to ask them now, Chief Goldstein? Does it take a little longer to screen those calls?
It does, and we do ask some of the calls, and we also know that 911, as a matter of course, is doing that as well. So we now know if we get a 911 transfer, we know that we may be going to an address that has an issue. But certainly we're asking the same type of questions when people do call in. And again, this is out of respect for them. This is out of respect for the neighbors, the community, and our officers who are responding. So we're not trying to frankly, pry into someone's personal life. We just have to know these things. This has become a self-preservative type of behavior.
Well, you got to protect your officers. And the CDC just recently said people now should wear masks when they're out in the public, at a grocery store or something, and social distancing may be difficult. Are your officers wearing masks, Chief Goldstein?
Again, I leave that to their discretion. We've been able to supply our officers with personal protective equipment, including masks, gowns, gloves, bleach, hand sanitizer, et cetera. So they have all of this in their cruises, a lot of this in the station, and I leave it to them to decide what the call necessitates as far as PPE is concerned. I'm not sure that I will. In fact, after I finish this call, I'm meeting with my command staff to discuss just that issue.
Wow.
And see where we want to go from there.
Well, it is so rapidly changing. And how are your supplies of these items if everybody decided, whoa, CDC says wear a mask, I'm going to wear one?
This is a very interesting thing as well. The city itself, all of the departments, including the school district, have kind of created a pool. And since the schools are closed, the school superintendent came to a meeting. We have a meeting every Monday, all of the department heads in the school. And he brought all kinds of stuff from the school. Since he didn't need it at this point in time, we really were most appreciative of the fact that he brought us bleach, hand sanitizer, and stuff like that. We've had a lot of offers. I know other departments have as well, for things such as gloves, latex gloves, protective clothing. And we're not shy. We'll say, yes, please. And so we're doing fairly well. But certainly we share amongst ourselves. If another department needs something, there's no hesitation. We'll certainly give you what we have.
Let's go to our listeners, Chief Goldstein. Again, our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Our email for you to join us with how New Hampshire's first responders are dealing with the coronavirus is exchange@nhpr.org. And right now we're getting the police perspective. A little bit later in the show, we'll talk with EMS and fire. Chief Goldstein, Karen in Plainfield is calling in. Go ahead, Karen, you're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, thanks for listening to me. Thanks for this wonderful program. I was wondering if in the questioning of the calls that come in, if the police and first responders could get medical and mental and situational information so that they could know if there's somebody with a mental illness or somebody with COVID or somebody with a heart attack or whatever, so that they could arrive on the scene with the right perspective.
Yeah, how much information do you get so that you can do the right thing once you get there? Karen, thank you very much for the call. Chief Goldstein?
Well, again, we try to get some basic information. Right now, everything seems to focus on COVID. And that's realistic. And quite frankly, in the past, other issues have come up. So Karen asked about, let's say, a heart attack. Certainly we want to know these things. And certainly if the call goes to 911, they have protocols for asking questions such as that. If the call comes directly to us and my dispatchers feel that they need to ask more, they will do that. This is nothing new to dispatch, by the way. They know that there's certain information they need to be able to pass along to the units that are going to be responding so that they can be prepared. We don't always get everything we need, and sometimes the information is incorrect, but certainly we're flexible enough to be able to work with that as well.
Sure. Standard dispatch procedures, Chief Goldstein, would try to get as much of that information as possible, recognizing that people are often in a panic when they call the police.
Certainly. Absolutely. And I rely just as heavily on my dispatchers. As I do my officers, to use their experience, their training, their education to be able to make these decisions.
Well, Karen, thank you for the call. And since you're talking about your dispatchers and your officers, I want to return to something you said earlier, Chief Goldstein. You said the most stressful thing for you about all this is your concern for the safety and well-being of your staff. And could we just talk about that second part, the well-being? How is your staff sort of doing emotionally, mentally, with the new challenges that this presents?
Well, we're seeing a little bit of everything right now. But I'd like to back up just a little bit and remind people that we have been doing this all along anyway, in a much smaller way. But if we go to a crime scene, if we go into a house that perhaps someone has been a hoarder, if we go somewhere that we're are familiar with will be diseases of other sorts, let's say. We've been doing this all along. We're always prepared for this type of thing, going into these types of environments. What COVID has done, obviously, is it's just expanded this exponentially to a point where we have to be much more careful. But my officers and my civilian staff, we act just like any other human being. We have a job to do, and we will do it. But at the same time, we also approach that with our strengths and our weaknesses. And certainly all of my my staff who have family and friends are concerned beyond just their jobs. So what are they bringing home? We don't really know the vectors that are in play here necessarily. I don't know who's touched what with whom, who's been with whom, nor do they. So we're always very careful about that. But what I do want my officers and civilian staff to know is there's always support. We always have emotional support. This is a critical time, so we have critical incident teams, we have stress management, all of that as well.
Well, and the last time we talked, actually, I think, Chief Goldstein, we talked about workforce issues, not just in your department in Franklin, but many departments around the state were facing staff shortages even before all this hit. What workforce issues are you facing now, Chief Goldstein? Sounds like nobody is out with COVID-19 on your staff. That's good, but I'm just wondering how you're approaching this, given that you were short-staffed to begin with.
Well, one of the other things we're going to be discussing at the meeting is changing our scheduling, just in case, so we could go to a different schedule if we had to. We, like so many other departments, are working with bare-bones personnel. I am at my limit. If I lose a police officer, just let's say for an everyday cold and he takes a day off, or she takes a day off, then I have to fill that spot if I can. There are times when I have to run short. There are times when I have to make adjustments. So that's our biggest concern. We've been dealing with this for quite some time now. We don't have the luxury of a very large police department where I can grab someone out of the detective bureau, for example, and put them on the road as a line officer, or take someone out of an administrative position and put them into a more active or functional position on the road. So that's my big concern when it comes down to personnel. Is the
ability
to provide.
I can see that because, again, if an officer right now got a cold, he or she might be out for, you know, 4 or 5 days. If somebody on your team gets COVID-19, you have to keep them out for 2 weeks. That's a long time to cover that shift when you're already short-staffed.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's a huge concern from the command point of view.
How solid are the sick leave policies in Franklin and in police departments in general, Chief Goldstein?
As far as...
In terms of, like, police officers have sick leave, they can use it. It's not one of these situations where people
don't. I would say that most departments are probably very similar. We do. They can. Our officers and civilian staff accrue sick leave on a monthly basis. They can use it for whatever they want. There are some restrictions. If you will, you can't use it for vacation time, that type of thing. But certainly, if you're bona fide illness, we accept that. Sometimes we will need a doctor's note to have an officer or member of the civilian staff come back to work just to make sure they're okay, which is what we're doing now, what we did with our two members who we thought might be infected and needed medical clearance. But that's logical anyway. I would be surprised if any department didn't do that. So I think we have a very solid and liberal sick leave policy here in Franklin.
What are you hearing from other police chiefs around the state, Chief Goldstein? I know you guys are all in touch.
Yeah, it's... That's a good question, and we're talking. We talk virtually, in some cases, almost daily. We do have a discussion at least once a week. Some of the committees get together offline, if you will. Everybody's going through pretty much the same thing. Large departments, small departments, doesn't matter. We're all very concerned with our people. We're all very concerned with our communities. And we certainly want to do the best we can by them. So we take a little bit of information from each other and implement it if it's useful. And that's why, for example, with the potential schedule change, I'm noticing some other departments are doing that, and I believe that we may have to follow suit. So I want to know what another chief has to say. And certainly I'm not reticent about picking up a phone and making a call and asking for some input.
So schedule change, like longer shifts, but with larger breaks. Is that what you're talking about?
Or exactly.
Looking at Chief Goldstein?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, so, for example, might go from an 8-hour shift to a 12-hour shift, or maybe a 24-on, 24-off, that type of thing. So we're going to explore all of, we have been, but we're going to explore even further those possibilities.
Well, last question for you, Chief Goldstein. Again, we really appreciate your time. And in a moment, we're going to talk to EMS and fire. What do you want your city's residents to understand about what it means to be a police officer in this, you know, pretty stressful time?
Our job is to put ourselves on the line. It may sound melodramatic, may sound silly, may sound even quaint and trite, but it's very true. Our job is to be there 24/7, 365. After that, we will worry about ourselves and our families and the ones that we care for. But when someone calls, we will come. It might take a little longer. It might not get the service that people are used to. It's a little bit like what we were told when the towels started to disappear from the shelves. We were told that the supply chain is there. It's just that you may not be getting bounced. You may be getting some other type of paper towel, but you'll still get a paper towel. So we're still there, and our citizens know that, and certainly they're welcome to call. And we've been able to deal a lot with over the phone as well, as a lot of departments have. So I'm very satisfied with that as well.
Well, David Goldstein, stay safe. And thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
My distinct pleasure. Anytime, Laura.
That's David Goldstein, Chief of Police in Franklin. Coming up, we turn to emergency medical services and fire departments, and we'll hear from you, your questions and personal stories about first responders in New Hampshire and how they're responding to the coronavirus. You can call us at 1-800-892-6477, or you can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And this is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. Today, how New Hampshire's first responders are managing their jobs in the midst of a pandemic. For them, working from home is not an option, and social distancing is often not possible. Let's hear from you. What personal experiences do you have with this? Or just what questions do you have about what you've seen in your community? Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or Twitter as well. We heard earlier from Franklin's police chief, David Goldstein. We're talking now with Chris Stawaz. He's regional director of American Medical Response for New Hampshire and Maine. It's a private provider of emergency medical services in several communities, including Nashua and Manchester. The company also provides disaster relief across the country. Chris, welcome. Really good to have you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me today.
And also with us, Guy Newbury, interim fire chief for the city of Concord. And Chief Newbury, a big welcome to you too. Thank you.
Thank you, Laura.
Well, I'd like to start with both of you with the same question I asked Franklin's police chief Goldstein. And Chief Newbury, maybe you first. What's most stressful for you about this and the team of people that you work with?
Well, probably just keeping track of the amount of information that continues to come out, tracking that information, make sure we're getting that information out to the people on the floor that have to apply the changes that we're seeing. And just tracking that, managing it. We're putting out daily situation reports to everybody. A lot of this has been about communicating because it was new to everybody, the level of changes that we've seen. A little bit stressful how they operate, and then we tell them one thing on a Monday, and by Thursday or Friday it's changed. So it's staying in front of it and constant communications because we have made a lot of changes quite quickly that we don't normally see in fire and EMS.
Wow, and I think a lot of listeners can relate to what you're saying, Chief Newbury. No matter what your field, there's so much information, and what you are told you're supposed to do on Monday, you're right, changes by Friday, and here you are trying to communicate with firefighters about that. So I'll have a lot more questions for you about that in a minute. But Chris Stawas, how about you on the EMS side? What's most stressful for you about this whole coronavirus and fears around COVID-19 and social distancing and everything?
Well, I would completely agree with the chief that, you know, in this business, normally we have a pretty set standard of how we practice, and everybody adheres to that. But the information that we're receiving literally changes from sometimes hour to hour about the best practices that we have out there. And being able to keep our providers up to date on what those best practices are so that they're safe and the people that we're taking care of are safe is really a big challenge for us to do. Almost like information overload on some days.
Well, right. And then you absorb the information and it changes. So I completely understand what you're talking about. Chris, I've talked to a lot of healthcare workers over the past couple weeks. And, you know, the big complaint I'm still hearing is lack of enough personal protective equipment, you know, gloves and masks and gowns and so forth. How are your supplies at American Medical Response?
Our supplies, fortunately, have continued to be adequate. We have a very good logistical chain set up. We're the nation's largest ambulance service provider with over 7,000 ambulances on the ground across the country. So we're able to supply one another in an emergent situation, if you will. But we've got, an adequate supply to make sure that our people are safe. As I said, changes on a daily basis. You know, we're wearing masks on every call now, where a week ago we weren't doing that. So that changes our what we call our burn rate of how many pieces of PPE or personal protective equipment that we go through. So we have a team of people that just manage our PPE on a daily basis and predict out where we're going to be a week or two from now so that we can keep our suppliers in the loop and hopefully maintain an adequate.
How about you, Chief Newbury? Is this an issue for you at Concord's Fire Department, a lack of effective protective gear?
We started this in kind of a shortage. It came on so fast, nobody had the preparation ability to stockpile, so we didn't have a stockpile. We started going through stuff pretty rapidly. We tried to balance that with only using it on high-risk calls because we knew the shortage issues. But certainly after a little while, we started getting a lot of volunteer donations. We got stuff from the school districts when the schools closed down, and that really got us through a critical point to get us to we started getting some reserves from the state and the Strategic National Stockpile, and that was a big help. We've also in Concord Fire with a lead emergency management agency, so we coordinated with all the departments any excess stuff that they weren't using. Yeah, we also had to supply them with cleaning products, cleaning supplies, because that's a big part of this is constant cleaning and decon. Make sure we're deconning with the right equipment and doing it thoroughly. So it certainly is a challenge. It's a balance. We're monitoring it, like Chris says, every day, seeing what our burn rate is. Certainly our burn rate has now increased that we've had to use PPE on every call. We have to suspect that every patient is potentially a COVID-positive patient. We weren't doing that initially, and that's how we wound up having a quarantine as precautionary some members. So it's something we have to be very mindful of on a daily basis, our PPE usage.
Wow, it's a lot for you to juggle. And as you said, it reflects how much things have changed so quickly. You weren't initially sending people out on every call with personal protective equipment. Now you are. So I can see that you would go through that very quickly. Chris Stawas, I want to ask you about personal protective gear as well. And it sounds like you and Chief Newbury are doing okay. What are you looking at for next week or the week after, Chris, in terms of, you know, gear that you need to keep your workers safe?
That's a great question. You know, the predictions that are out there are that the surge in New Hampshire, anyway, will happen, you know, within the next 2 weeks or so. So, you know, we are predicting, anyway, that there will be an increase in the amount of, I'll call it full PPE that we use, which are gowns and gloves and eye protection, in addition to the surgical masks and N95s that you're hearing about. So, you know, we've upped our prediction models to include a higher use of all of those items so that we are trying to maintain a higher supply in what we call our par level of equipment that we have available to us. Kind of like a worst-case scenario of using full PPE head to toe on every single call we go on.
You know, Chris, I'm curious. So I completely understand you've got people fully outfitted, especially as people expect the surge to happen here in New Hampshire in the next week or two. What's the sort of psychological impact on somebody who, let's say they've been in a car accident or something, and they're in shock, they're in panic, and then the EMS shows up, and instead of sort of seeing a kind face, they see somebody in like full hazmat gear. Do you know what I'm trying to get at, Chris? Like, what's the impact on the patient of seeing somebody fully outfitted like that?
I do, yeah. And there was actually, because those things, that's a good point, those things do continue to happen. You know, we continue to respond to motor vehicle crashes, and people continue to do, I'll call them normal things. People have cardiac disease, people continue to deliver babies, all those things that happen to a human continue to happen every day. And we have to not only take care of the folks who are suffering from COVID-related illnesses, but everything else that we normally do on a regular day as well. So I think with the amount of press and knowledge that's out there, people aren't surprised to see us come in full PPE. They understand that it's not only for our protection, but for their protection as well. We see a kind set of eyes now instead of a kind face.
Yeah.
So, we do the best we can to provide people with the emotional support that we can, and our crews as well, because, these are people who come to work every day so that people can stay home every day and not catch the virus. And we want to have our people be able to go home at night to their families and feel comfortable that they haven't been exposed to anything that's going to put their family in danger. So
right.
That's the important piece, that everybody goes home safe at the end of the day.
Well, I want to invite our listeners again to join us with an email exchange at nhpr.org. We're talking to first responders, how they are dealing with the new demands, the constantly changing information and practices surrounding the coronavirus. Again, our email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or Twitter. Again, the email is exchange@nhpr.org. Chief Newbury, how has this whole pandemic changed the types of calls for help that you get from the public, Chief Newbury?
Well, certainly our call volume is down slightly. Just, I think, was indicated earlier on the calls. People are out less, driving less, doing things less. So the call volume is slightly down. We're evaluating patients differently, trying to dissuade them from going to the hospital if they don't need to for their own benefit and ours. So that's certainly different. We've actually seen an increased call volume in people being out and about, as far as going in the woods, getting lost in the woods, having to get rescued from the woods. We had an event that took several hours one cold, rainy night last week that somebody was very lost in the woods. We worked with one of our mutual aid towns. We were called to assist, actually, and with Fish and Game. And we were able to get them out of the woods. I think it was like at 4 in the morning, finally. So you'll see more and more people out on trails, biking. People that may not have biked in a long time are now out there biking. So people are still getting hurt, doing crazy things.
Oh, my gosh.
So
fewer car accidents and more bike accidents.
I think you'll start to see that more and more.
How much of your operations, I'm just curious, Chief Newbury, are related to fire, and how much are emergency medical assistance, and is it all just one combination? You know, it's everything together.
Well, general numbers, I'm not talking about right now during this event because we haven't done a recent tracking. Certainly our call volume is down slightly. But generally we say 80-20, and it may even be slightly higher than that. But the 20% being everything else that we do, hazmat, fire, you know, all the other things that we're involved in, and then the 80% being EMS related, in some nature, whether it's, direct medical calls or vehicle accidents that result in medical emergencies, that type of stuff.
That's interesting. And Chris DeWaas, one of the comments that I heard from a lot of other emergency medical professionals, when you ask them about their stress, they say the constant cleaning is really stressful. What about that, Chris? I mean, obviously the ambulances that your company runs are perfectly clean and disinfected, but I have read that there's a whole new level of cleaning and disinfecting that you have to do, and that that takes time and it's stressful. So tell us about that, Chris.
It does. And we've actually invested in a couple of what we call foggers, so that once a week, the ambulance, when it goes into the maintenance shop for its check, the mechanics are using an approved solution to fog the interior of the ambulance that will disinfect it, in addition to what we do on a normal basis and after every call. It's kind of an added level of protection, if you will, that will decontaminate the entire interior of the ambulance, including the cab area where the crew sits, so that they can feel a little bit more protected. And we're also doing that in our stations as well, because there is a lot of human activity in our station where people are coming and going from work and in the areas that they wait for calls. So we're trying as best we can to address every potential aspect of decontamination throughout our buildings and vehicles and garages and you name it. We're looking for any opportunity we can to keep things clean.
And Chief Neuber, I was looking at some of the CDC guidance on this, and boy, it sounded complicated, kind of relating to what Chris DeWaas says. There's this whole sort of air filtering system that you're supposed to do, and there's one set of protocols if the cab is separate. There's another set of protocols if the cab isn't separate. Can you just describe the stepped-up cleaning and decontamination that you have to do now of the ambulances here in Concord?
Yeah, so same kind of idea. We do the original decon after we've transferred a patient at the hospital. We do an initial decon up there and change out of PPE and everything. Then we'll bring our ambulance to our central fire station and do an additional decon with a fogging type device that you let the product stay on or dwell time for about 10 minutes to kill anything additional that we maybe haven't touched or seen. So we are taking all kinds of additional precautions from the get-go. So even members are now enhancing their decon in the station, so they're not wearing the same footwear that they wear out on calls as they do inside the living quarters of the station. So we're trying everything we can to provide them, you know, proper PPE, but a lot of it is on the individual to make sure they're doing everything they can to, you know, not only put on the PPE correctly, but take it back off. So we've done additional enhanced trainings with all our personnel, you know, in both really donning, doffing equipment. And we've put a lot of onus on the supervisor to make sure that they are paying attention to every one of these calls. We're approaching them all like a mini hazmat, if you would. It's a hazmat incident. And we know how to handle those. We've done them for years. We know how to protect our people. So it's kind of that same concept. It's no longer looking at all these as a straight, you know, chest pain call or difficulty breathing. It's a combination of we can't help them if we're not protected. So
sure.
It's certainly a different way of approaching them.
Well, it's a lot to think about. And coming up, more on how emergency medical services and fire departments are finding their work dramatically changed by the coronavirus. Keep your responses coming in. We'd love to hear your stories and your questions. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook or Twitter. Once again, that email, exchange@nhpr.org. And this is The Exchange from New Hampshire Public Radio. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, how a pandemic has changed the way New Hampshire's first responders work. What personal experiences do you have with this? Do you work in one of these professions, or do you have questions about what you've seen in your own community? Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Once again, exchange@nhpr.org. You can use Facebook. You can use Twitter. We'd love to hear from you. We talked earlier with Franklin's police chief. Our guests right now are Chris DeWaas, Regional Director of American Medical Response for New Hampshire and Maine. That's a private provider of emergency medical services in several communities, including Nashua and Manchester. Also with us, Guy Newbury, Interim Fire Chief for the city of Concord. One more time, we welcome your emails at exchange@nhpr.org. And Kenneth wrote in, he says, the Civil Air Patrol is involved in distributing PPE to healthcare facilities, fire departments, etc. Kenneth says, I participated in this exercise yesterday. We had two trailers and a van, picked up supplies from the New Hampshire National Guard warehouse in Concord, and went to distribute the materials. The trailers received a state trooper escort. Kenneth, thank you so much for that email. And I think, Chris, it kind of relates to what you and Chief Newbury were saying earlier. You guys are getting donations from people who care about you.
We are. There's a significant amount of really great people that are donating not only PPE, but cleaning supplies as well to local fire departments and to the State Emergency Operations Center. And in addition to that, to the alternative care sites that have been stood up across the state, I believe there's 14 of them now in total.
Wow.
Where potentially, if hospitals get overloaded, patients could be taken to receive additional care. So those are some pretty impressive sites that have been stood up by a number of different agencies, hospitals, the National Guard has helped out. Local fire, police, EMS have really, and public health in particular, have worked to prepare these facilities in case, patients are overloading the local hospitals.
Well, and Chief Goldstein and Chief Newbury told us about donations from the schools. Since the schools are closed, they're not using them. Chris, I did have a question about something concerning your organization in particular. From what I understand, you sent two ambulance crews and two strike team leaders to New York City, given how bad the crisis is down there. What are they doing, Chris, in New York, and have you heard from them yet?
I have heard from them. I actually talk to them every day. We are AMR is a national FEMA contractor, so we deploy ambulances to national disasters across the country. Normally, it's for a hurricane. I was in South Carolina last fall, and I think Georgia the year before that. I kind of all blends together, but it's normally a hurricane response. Right now, we're in New York City with over 250 ambulances deployed there to FEMA. Working with FDNY, doing not only 911 calls, but work to decompress some of the hospitals, bringing patients to and from the Javits Center and the USS Comfort. So our folks are on the ground. Our particular crews from New Hampshire are working in the 911 system. They are extremely busy, giving the EMS workers at FDNY a little bit of a break, if you will.
Sure.
In responding to the volume there, and they're doing okay. They're being treated extremely well. Some great camaraderie down there. They have everything they need, and they are working really hard to take care of the citizens of New York City.
Well, and when they come back, Chris, will they have to quarantine for 14 days?
You know, that's an excellent question. We're actually working through the CDC on that because, as you can imagine, there's a high level of COVID in New York City.
Right.
And we want to make sure that they're safe. So we will work with the CDC and get the proper guidance on that to make sure that these folks come back and can continue working here and be safe with their families at home.
Well, and Chief Newbury, from what I understand, you had some members of your department that had to quarantine for a while, not necessarily because they tested positive, but because they were possibly exposed. Can you tell us a little bit more about how you managed that? And, did they have to quarantine? How did you cover their shifts, so to speak? I mean, how did that work for you?
So, yeah, it was early on in the event a couple of weeks ago now that we were not using PPE on every incident. And it was unbeknownst to us, it was somebody in that household that had tested. So we, thankfully, the state came out with some pretty good guidelines for this, a series of three algorithms that you figure out where the exposure fell into which category, and then it gives you guidance as to how to proceed. And we've been using those on a regular basis when members have potential exposure. So most of the ones after that have all been family-related because many fire department members have a spouse that works in the healthcare profession, and unfortunately they are also at high risk. So a lot of these have been precautionary where there's been a spouse that's potentially exposed or is awaiting testing. So precautionary, they've been put on some type of a quarantine. And so that's how the state was very proactive in coming out with those algorithms, and it's been very helpful. We keep them right in on the desk, basically, to look up, okay, where do you fall in which one, and what do we got to do, how long. The testing has helped a lot now that testing has become more available so we can get people back quicker. At one point, we were waiting like almost 12 days for test results to come back for a patient. That's been sped up a lot in the last few weeks. We now have all around the state, the convenient MD can do first responder testing for us, so we can get there and get those test results sent to the state lab so we can track them easier and know where they're at and the timeline for the test, which are coming back much quicker. So prior to this, it would go to a private lab sometimes through a hospital that we were waiting for patient test results, and we wouldn't even know where they were for quite a period of time. So testing has improved, and I think we're about to, pretty soon, I understand, they will have the 15-minute test kits out, which would help again.
That's really interesting, Chief. So, you know, 2-3 weeks ago, let's say you had 2 staff members respond to an emergency, and there was concern about exposure, you'd lose those people for 2 weeks. Now they can come back to work pretty quickly thanks just to faster testing. That's a huge deal for you, isn't it?
Yeah, it's from the beginning, this has been about the testing and quick test results, because if the test results for the patient are negative, then there's no exposure. So even though they may have been symptomatic, and that's why we transported them, if met the criteria that you have exhibited symptoms for COVID, if the test results are negative, then they didn't have an exposure. Now we've kind of changed, we're just reinforcing the model. If you have proper PPE on, you've done everything right, you do not have an exposure. We've transported, positive patients, and, we're not losing members to an exposure because they're doing everything right, have proper PPE on, do good decon.
All right. Well, again, our email address is exchange@nhpr.org, and we'd love your questions and comments about how New Hampshire's first responders are just dealing with all the demands and changes surrounding coronavirus. And both of you, I'd love to throw this question from Julie in Durham at you because it's a great one. Julie asks, what's being done to support the mental health of first responders at this time? Julie, thank you so much. And Chris Dewas, I'll go to you first.
Well, thanks. On a normal day, if there is such a thing anymore, we're always concerned with the mental health of our staff, because generally they see things that the average citizen doesn't. They're involved in many life and death situations and having to make some very critical decisions at a moment's notice. So our concern for them and their mental well-being is always there, and it's even more so now. We're working with a number of different agencies to provide things such as an employee assistance program on the ground with our staff and managers who are constantly interacting with our staff to make sure that they're okay, that their families are okay, that they have time to be able to be off the job to spend with their families, and that they are able to be financially sound so that those things don't worry them on the backside of their day either. So a tremendous amount of effort into the on-the-ground folks, the leadership folks, and everyone who's dealing with this crisis to make sure that we're all mentally well and able to continue to focus on the needs of the community.
Yeah. How about you, Chief Newbury? I love Julie's question. Thank you, Julie.
It's certainly something we've been concerned with early on, and we've pushed out on our daily situation report all kinds of resources for members to be aware of and mindful of. Our human resource department has been a big help with this as well. We also pulled in clergy to make sure, we do have a fire department chaplain. It's just another resource. We realize this has taken its toll on some members. Generally, firefighters are a pretty social group, and that's how we deal with day-to-day stress. So this has been an interesting challenge in not being able to do that. Combine that with potential risk to your family, which is a whole nother issue. generally, it's, you know, whether we're dealing with firefighter cancer or other issues, if you worry about yourself so much but not your family. So now it's that extra piece of this that you hope you're doing everything right so you're not impacting your family, which certainly adds a level of stress.
Well, Julie, thank you. And Tina sent us an email who says a huge thank you to all our first responders. Tina also says to everyone out there, please keep them in your prayers and help them by being smart. Tina says, don't go out and do crazy things right now. That is the best way you can help. Again, we need our first responders healthy and able to respond. Show them some love, Tina says. Wow, Tina, that's great. And it is a question that I want to ask both of you. So, Chief Newborough, I'll ask you first, you know, what can the public do to make your job a little bit easier?
A couple of things. One is when you're asked a series of questions, if you do call 911, first of all, we ask you to only call if it's a true emergency. Prior to this, we would transport a lot of people that was doubtful whether it was a true emergency, but we would take them to the hospital. Now we're really trying to dissuade people from doing that. We don't want to tie up the ER. We don't want to expose them to things as well. And got to remember, once we do any transport, it starts the whole decon procedure that's going to tie us up for well over an hour. And it burns up a lot of PPE, unfortunately. That's the other key piece. So don't call unless you really need us. Call if you do. We're not saying don't call. Call if you do. We're going to take you. We're going to treat you. We're going to do the right thing. But do an evaluation. Maybe call your own family doctor or use telemedicine, which is becoming the thing right now. And the other thing is if E911 asks you the series of questions, be truthful about, you know, if how you're feeling and what your symptoms may be. We just gives us that ability to enhance protection and protect the first responders as well as you. And if we ask you to wear a mask, please don't be insulted. You know, it's for your protection as well as everybody else. So that would be the key things.
Sure, and I can totally see what you're saying about, you know, unnecessary transport to the hospital, given the heightened amount of cleaning and decontamination that you have to do. How about you, Chris? How would you answer that question and that email from Tina? How can the general public help you guys do your jobs?
Well, I would echo many of the things that the chief said. Make smart decisions when you're trying to decide what you're going to do for the day. I know this is a big crimp on a lot of people's lifestyles and just the way that we are. People like to be out and about doing things and moving around, but this is not the time to do that. There's got to be some sacrifice involved from people to understand that they need to stay inside. They need to stay low-key and avoid other human contact right now through social distancing and just making smart decisions. The chief mentioned earlier that people have gone hiking and gotten lost and gotten hurt. Those things just add undue burden on the public safety system that is here to take care of us all. And right now, given the circumstances that we're in, we need to make sure that that system is being used only for true emergencies. And if you don't need to be out doing it, don't go out and do it. It'll still be there to do when you are out of quarantine and we're past this peak of the virus, if you will.
Well, I've been asking a lot of my guests this lately, and I'd like to ask you, Chris, what makes you feel hopeful at this point?
Well, absolutely. What makes me feel hopeful is seeing all of my staff and all the other public safety agencies coming to work every day and just doing the job. These people put their head down and they put their mask on now and they go to work. And there is no question in their mind that they're going to go in and take care of people the best way that they know how, regardless of what they're walking into or regardless of what they're asked to do. They are just absolute heroes in my book and are have always been, but even more so now. They're just doing what they need to do and not asking any questions about why. They are here for people, and I could not be prouder of all of them.
Chief Newbury, how about you? What gives you hope? It's a tough time.
Like Chris said, morale is actually very good. Morale is up. Employees are showing up. They're very engaged. They're you know, they're not challenging us on our changes that we're rolling out on a regular basis. So we got great cooperation from our employee groups, the unions, support from City Hall with, you know, sick leave coverage issues. We're working really close with other city departments like PD. So we've had a great relationship, and it's given us great opportunities that way to work together. That's the most hopeful.
Well, Chief Newbury, it was really good to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Guy Newbury, Interim Fire Chief of the City of Concord. And Chris Dewas, good to have you too. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, and good to speak with you. And Chief, stay safe up there.
Chris Dewas is Regional Director of American Medical Response for New Hampshire and Maine. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Our executive producer is Michael Brindley. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our fellow is Jane Vaughn, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.